This is Pacifica Radio's Letters from Politics. On today's show,
whenever Haider made like one of these extremist statements, they ran a cover story with Haider. A color picture of Haider in front, sometimes comparing him to Hitler on the cover and so on. Yeah? So what the liberal mainstream media did is they constructed Haider's scandals as a spectacle, and this in the end gave him lots of media attention, and the magazines knew if they put Haider on the cover, then amount of magazines they sell will double in these specific weeks. So they increased their profit. At the same time, it did not much harm Haider, actually, yeah, because it gave him so much media presence in 1999, and his party then became the junior partner in a coalition, which so it was the first time that in post-Second World War politics in Europe, a right-wing extremist party came part of a European government.
Jörg Haider was a far-right populist leader in Austria who said incendiary things in order to increase the amount of media attention he and his party received. It would help land his party into Austria's parliament. Today we'll examine right-wing authoritarian use of social media and the capitalist model that made such controversies as the one concerning Cambridge Analytica possible. Our guest is Christian Fuchs. Christian Fuchs is a professor at Westminster University and author of the book Digital Demagogue, Authoritarian Capitalism in the Age of Trump and Twitter. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The Louisiana Attorney General has announced he will not file criminal charges against two white Baton Rouge police officers in the fatal shooting of African-American Alton Sterling outside a Baton Rouge convenience store.
The officers attempted several non-lethal techniques to gain compliance and control of Mr. Sterling's hands. Their efforts to do so were a direct result of the information relayed to them by the Baton Rouge Police Department dispatcher. That was that Mr. Sterling was armed with a firearm.
Officers recovered a loaded revolver from Sterling's pocket. Attorneys for Sterling's relatives have said federal authorities told them that Officer Blaine Salamone pointed a gun at Sterling's head and threatened to kill him before the struggle began. In a summary of its findings, the Justice Department said Salamone pointed his gun at Sterling's head, but didn't mention any verbal threats by the officer who ultimately killed Sterling. An attorney for the family called the Louisiana Attorney General's decision not to prosecute the officers political. Sandra Sterling, who was his aunt and raised Alton, called it shameful.
It's shame on him and his committee for making that decision that he made on Alton Sterling. And for all the people that say that Alton Sterling was a bad man and he should have been killed, shame on y'all for that. Because you know what? You all have kids too. And to put Blaine Salamone back on the street of Baton Rouge, you put no killer back on the streets.
Cell phone videos of the shooting on social media sparked protests that led to nearly 200 arrests. The California Attorney General's office will independently investigate the fatal police shooting of 23-year-old unarmed African-American Stephon Clark. Clark was shot dead in his grandmother's backyard in Sacramento after officers thought the cell phone he was holding was a gun. Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn, the city's first black police chief, announced the decision with the California Attorney General at his side.
Due to the nature of this investigation, the extremely high emotions, anger, and hurt in our city, I felt it was the best interest of our entire community, including the members of our police department, to ask the Attorney General to be an independent part of this investigation.
Clark's shooting has sparked protests by hundreds of people. He died in a barrage of 20 bullets. His grandmother, Sakita Thompson, broke down as she addressed the media yesterday.
They didn't have to kill him like that. They didn't have to shoot him that many times. Why did you just shoot him in the arm, shoot him in the leg, send a dog, send a taser? Why? Justice. I want justice for my baby. I want justice for Stephon Clark.
Civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, who's representing the family, has called Clark's fatal police shooting an execution. California Attorney General Javier Becerra is set to announce a lawsuit to challenge the Trump administration's decision to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. The Census Bureau announced the addition, contending it would help enforce the Voting Rights Act. Becerra says the question is illegal and will discourage immigrants and their family members from responding. House Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi also blasted the idea. Pelosi said in a statement, it will terrify already vulnerable people and cause traditionally undercounted communities to be even further underrepresented, financially excluded, and left behind. The population count affects funding and the allocation of congressional seats. An undercount would have a disproportionate effect on states like California with large numbers of immigrants. British Prime Minister Theresa May has welcomed the mass expulsions of Russian diplomats from nearly two dozen allied nations. The expulsions came in the wake of the nerve agent poisoning in Britain of a former Russian spy and his daughter.
This is the largest collective expulsion of Russian intelligence officers in history. I have found great solidarity from our friends and partners in the EU, North America, NATO and beyond over the past 3 weeks as we have confronted the aftermath of the Salisbury incident.
The Trump administration yesterday announced the expulsion of 60 Russian diplomats and the shutdown of the consulate in Seattle. The Russian ambassador to the U.S. blamed this country for ruining relations between the two nations.
What the United States of America is doing today, they are destroying what little remained of U.S.-Russian ties. I would add that all the responsibility for ruining Russian-American relations is on the United States of America.
The remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera. Thousands of Russians took to the main square of a Siberian city to confront local officials whom they blame for a shopping mall fire that killed at least 64 people, most of them children. President Vladimir Putin visited the city. He blamed the deaths on criminal negligence as he laid flowers in tribute to the victims.
What's happening here is not a military action. It's not an unexpected release of methane at a mine. People and their children came here to get some rest. We are talking about demographic decline and losing so many people. To what? Due to criminal negligence, due to carelessness.
Witnesses reported fire alarms were silent, the public address system was off, and sprinklers did not work. Fire exits were blocked. Many victims were children, some of whom died in a movie theater that was locked to prevent people from sneaking in. Linda Brown, a central figure in the Brown versus Board of Education school segregation case, has died at the age of 75. The cause of death wasn't released. As a young girl, Brown's father tried to enroll her in the neighborhood all-white school in Topeka, Kansas. She recalled the day she learned of the Supreme Court decision.
The court's decision on ending segregation was unanimous. My mother was overwhelmed. On returning from school, I learned of the decision, which at that time meant only to me that my sisters wouldn't have to walk so far to school the next fall. That evening in our home was much rejoicing.
The 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court struck down racial segregation in schools and cemented Linda Brown's place in history as a central figure in the landmark case. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. With the internet and especially social media, there are now new and powerful platforms that can be used for many things, including demagoguery. Furthermore, there is a commercial value in demagoguery and fake news to persist. And in part, today, our guest argues is how we get to the controversy surrounding Cambridge Analytica and 50 million people's data being used for political purposes. Our guest, Christian Fuchs, also argues that this has grown out of an age of neoliberalism, which he says is transforming itself, as capitalism always does, into what he calls authoritarian capitalism. And that is what we are going to be in conversation about today. Christian Fuchs is a leading Marxist scholar. He teaches at Westminster University, and he is the author of the book Digital Demagogue, Authoritarian Capitalism in the Age of Trump and Twitter. Christian Fuchs, I thank you greatly for taking time to join us today.
Welcome.
Let's begin with the old media first, because you have some interesting historic parallels that I want to dive into. But begin by talking to me about this relationship between Donald Trump and the mainstream media, on broadcasting mainstream media and also newspapers. Commonly it's seen as Donald Trump is at war with mainstream media and mainstream media at war with him. Yet they're, you would argue, also very dependent upon one another.
Yes. So, I mean, on the one hand, there are the right-wing mainstream media like Vox and Vox News. And, of course, Trump is friends with the very far-right media, yeah, and also Breitbart and so on. But on the other hand, whom he considers as his main enemy, I would say, in terms of organizations, are the liberal U.S. media like CNN, the New York Times, and so on. And I made an analysis of, like, for 6 months, I gathered all tweets that Trump made, and then I analyzed who are the main enemies that he talks about in his tweets. And the majority of the negative tweets was about the media. If you look at whom he really tries to scapegoat most, then it is the media. Yeah? But at the same time, Trump also sells. Trump means attention also in the mainstream media. Yeah? And so while he did his campaign, there was so much reporting about him. Yeah? So I think almost all his campaign speeches and so on were live broadcast on CNN. So, and he acknowledges this himself, just being in the mainstream media is also gratis propaganda for him. He does not need to pay for it, yeah? Which then mean, I mean, if he would have to buy ads in the New York Times, this would be very expensive. But if he's constantly on the front cover, then this gives him also publicity. At the same time, of course, the profits, the advertising profits, the sales profits of the New York Times, CNN, and the liberal mainstream media were massively increasing. So in the end, this means that Trump and the liberal mainstream media, they have a love-hate relationship. They hate each other. Yeah? At the same time, they also require each other, because without the mainstream media, Trump would have much less public attention. And without having the opportunity to report about Trump, the liberal media would make much less profit. So Trump is really a media spectacle.
And you compared all of this to Jorg Haider. And maybe I'm not entirely sure if I'm saying his name correctly, but he was the leader of the far-right Austrian Freedom Party in the 1980s and 1990s. Can you tell me about him?
Yes. So Jorg Haider was from 1986 onwards the leader of the Austrian Freedom Party. The Austrian Freedom Party was created right after the Second World War, actually, yeah? And many former Nazis gathered in this Freedom Party. Yeah? So basically, it was a kind of post-Nazist party. Also, Jörg Haider's father was a member of the Nazi party. And since 1986, Haider implemented and represented the kind of politics that today Trump stands for. So he was an extreme narcissist. He presented himself as being young, modern, and dynamic. He was extremely xenophobic, racist. In the early 1990s, he started a referendum called Austria First, which was basically a referendum directed against immigration. So it was an anti-immigration referendum. So pretty much the same kind of anti-immigration politics that you can see nowadays with Trump. So Jörg Haider was a kind of prototype of the far-right demagogue. Yeah? He was also very successful with these politics. So since 1986 until 2000, his party constantly gained in elections. Yeah. So in the mid-1980s, they were just a 6-7% party. In 1999, they reached 27% of the vote with all the racist scapegoating and so on.
Well, is my understanding correct that what he would do is he would say some really incendiary things, it would outrage people, but it would also get him a lot of media coverage, and hence...
Exactly, yeah. So that's the comparison to Trump. So in the 1990s, he was making right-wing extremist statements. So the most infamous one was that he said that there were some positive aspects of Hitler's employment policies because finally people had jobs and so on. Yeah? But of course, we know that Hitler's employment policies just built the foundation for the Second World War, yeah? And was just built on armament. Yeah? So Haider deliberately created scandals in order to create media attention. And back then, also just like in the case of Trump nowadays, the liberal mainstream media, not so much television, but especially the weekly magazines. Yeah, weekly magazines, one called Profil and another one called the News magazine. Whenever Haider made one of these extremist statements, they ran a cover story with Haider. Yeah? A color picture of Haider in front, sometimes comparing him to Hitler on the cover and so on. Yeah? So what the liberal mainstream media did is they constructed Haider's scandals as a spectacle, and this in the end gave him lots of media attention because people suddenly there were 15 pages in the magazine cover story just devoted to Haider, and people were reading this, yeah, and the magazines knew if they put Haider on the cover, then the amount of magazines they sell will double in these specific weeks. So they increased their profit. At the same time, it did not much harm Haider, actually, yeah, because it gave him so much media presence. Yeah, it actually supported his support in the population. And then it ended up 27% of the vote in 1999. And his party then became the junior partner in a coalition. Yeah, it was the first time that in post-Second World War politics in Europe, a right-wing extremist party became part of a European government. Yeah? And the media were, of course, not predominantly, but were partly to blame also for it, yeah, because they gave him so much attention. Yeah? So it might simply be, and we can also see this in the case of Trump, it might simply be the wrong strategy to constantly focus and report about the right-wing demagogues. Sometimes it might just be easier to ignore them, yeah, and to not report about all of these scandals and so on, and to give them much less media attention. So the way you can really harm them is just to not report, yeah, to be silent sometimes, and so on. Yeah,
fake news sells, and it always has been good for profit. This is something I've also learned just in reading your work, is that in 1835, in New York, the New York Sun did a six-part series on how life had been found on the moon, which, of course, was not true. This is 1835, more than 150 years before we get to the moon. Yet subscription rates, or at least circulation, went up dramatically for the New York Sun.
Yeah, exactly. So in this story, it became known as the Great Moon Hoax. Yeah? So the New York Sun wrote a feature piece saying that life on moon was discovered. Yeah, and I quote what they wrote back there. They said, "We discovered a small kind of reindeer, the elk, the moose, the horned bear, and the piped beaver, and also human bats who were doubtless innocent and happy creatures." And people bought into this story. And of course, it's a fake news story. And as you were saying, like, the circulation massively increased. Yeah? So, but what this example shows us is that in using the term fake news is not just about social media where user-generated stories that do not accord to reality circulate. Fake news is much older. So if it existed already in the 19th century, then this is an indication that fake news is really the essence of tabloid media. So fake news sells, fake news results in profits. And that's what we can just see by the history of tabloid media. Yeah? At the same time, this also means if fake news is an imminent feature of tabloid media, and if tabloid media is a capitalist strategy for media to increase their profits. Then this also means that we will only get rid of fake news if we get rid of the capitalist character of the media. And in the 1840s, Karl Marx, you know, he was a journalist also, he cared a lot about the freedom of the press. As a journalist, he worked also as an editor for the Rheinische Zeitung first and then for the Neue Rheinische Zeitung, which back then was banned by the Prussian state, which is why he had to leave Germany. He had to flee first to Paris, then to Brussels, then to the United Kingdom. And back then, he wrote a lot about the freedom of the press. There's one famous quote there by Marx, where Marx said, the first freedom of the press and the first freedom of the media is to operate not as a business, which implies then that if you operate the media as a business where the interest is just to make profit, then you will end up with limiting freedom and also with limiting democracy. But so the threat to democracy posed by capitalist media is a very old one, really. Yeah, and we ought to better think about how we can make media reforms so that we can strengthen the democratic character of the public sphere.
That's interesting. We've talked a lot over the years about Karl Marx on this program. I don't think we've ever talked about his views towards the press.
Yeah, one should not forget. I mean, the 5th of May this year, 2018, is Karl Marx's bicentenary, his 200th birthday. Yeah? So there are lots of discussions about Marx. Yeah? But within Marx's theory, there's predominantly a focus on political economy and on economic crisis, yeah? On how the economic system develops and so on. But I'm a critical communication theorist, so I'm interested in how critical theorists, including Marx, also wrote about the means of communication. And Marx, I mean, on the one hand, wrote about the new media of his time, the communication technologies, which back then was the telegraph. Yeah? But Marx saw correctly that new media change the way that space and time are organized. Yeah? And back then, already in the Communist Manifesto and in other writings, in Capital, Volume 1, in Grundrisse, and so on, he showed how the telegraph helped globalizing capitalism. Yeah? Back then, it was about the establishment of the world market and so on. And so he spoke of the means of communication. They played a role there. Yeah? Interestingly, in the Grundrisse, Marx envisions a kind of a global system of communication, which did not exist at his time. He says a global system of communication where each person can inform him or herself about all other people and where connections between human beings are being established. Yeah? So a global information system and a system, communication system of networking, this sounds almost like the internet. Yeah. So some people therefore say that it might have been Karl Marx inventing the internet in 1857. Of course, back then you could not build the internet physically, yeah? But at least he had this idea of the internet. And of course, the media of his time, it was also the newspapers. Yeah. But back then, when Marx was writing, the newspapers did not have such a commercial character as they have today. So advertising funded newspapers became dominant in the early 20th century. Back then, newspapers had a much more political character. Yeah, were partly politically funded. I mean, the radical newspapers by trade unions and radical political movements and so on. Yeah, what Marx opposed in terms of the freedom of the press were, on the one hand, state censorship. Yeah, because there was Prussian state censorship of the newspapers he was writing for. And on the one hand, he saw that commercial news and media would also be harmful. And that's all ideas you can find in his writings on the freedom of the press from the early 1840s. Yeah? So it's also a mistake to assume that Marx is not the same as Marxism. Yeah? And of course, how Marxism was partly implemented in the 20th century did no longer accord to Marx's ideas. Yeah? So if you think of Maoism in China or Stalinism in the Soviet Union, Yeah, the economy was completely state-controlled. And of course, in China and in the Soviet Union, also the press was state-controlled. Yeah. However, this would not, Marx would have completely opposed state control of the media, yeah, state censorship, because he did that already in the 1840s concerning the Prussian state censorship. So Marx is an early thinker of the freedom of the press and of the democratic public sphere and a media democracy.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Christian Fuchs, who's a professor at the University of Westminster, and he is the author of the book Digital Demagogue, Authoritarian Capitalism in the Age of Trump and Twitter. There's a lot there to talk about. I want to follow up with somebody else you wrote about, and that's a psychologist that from the past that we've done shows on in the past here as well, and that's Wilhelm Reich, who's an interesting character, maybe the only person who could say his books were burned both in Nazi Germany and in the United States, a controversial figure himself. But there's something that he wrote that I think is important, and he said, you cannot communicate with the masses through reason, through argument, but only through appeals to emotion.
Yes, so Wilhelm Reich was a communist psychologist living in Germany, like many others who were Jewish and socialists. He had to flee to the US. In terms of how fascism and right-wing authoritarianism was analyzed in Marxist theory in the 1920s, was predominantly in political and economic terms. Yeah? So one was arguing that fascism is a form of totalitarian monopoly capitalism and so on. Reich agrees with this, but he says this is not enough. Yeah? One must also look at the ideological and the psychological dimension of how right-wing authoritarianism operates. Yeah? And he looks specifically then at emotions and how right-wing extremist ideology does not operate through rational arguments, but it always appeals to the emotions and to the fears of human beings. Yeah? And if you nowadays look at Trump, then especially when he makes xenophobic and racist arguments, then that's not a rational argument. Yeah, or when he argues that that immigrants from Muslim countries are terrorists and so on. These are not things that can be underpinned by facts, these kind of generalizations. Yeah, like all Mexicans are illegals and just want to come to the US in order to do drug trafficking and rape our women and so on. So that's not, all data shows that these are just prejudices and that it's wrong. Yeah. However, the question is, why do people still react to it positively? Yeah? And the problem is, the racist and people who are xenophobic will often not take rational arguments serious, yeah? Because racism appeals to emotions, and it appeals to underlying unconscious fears that people have. And of course, one of the reasons why Trump has been successful in the US and why other far-right-wing demagogues have been successful, especially now also in Europe, like Orban, for example, in Hungary, yeah, or also others, is that they speak to these fears that people have. Yeah? And especially because since the 1970s, inequality has been rising. So neoliberalism has resulted in wage repression, which meant that the wages of the mass of people have been stagnating, yeah? Whereas the profits have been increasing. So where the rich became richer, the poor became poorer, precarious labor was rising, social insecurity was rising, and so on. Yeah? And of course, neoliberalism has created great anxiety and fear of everyday people, and especially also of working class people, of social degradation. Yeah? Who is to blame for this? It's not a single person or a group of people. It's neoliberal capitalism as such. And what Trump now does, and that's where he's an ideologue and a demagogue, is that he deflects attention constantly from the structural causes of inequality by blaming single people and single groups. And if you direct politics not against structures or against a system, because that's fairly abstract, if you direct it against people, then this can be done in very effective and emotional terms. That's what Trump does, and that's why Wilhelm Reich's analysis shows us that the psychological and the emotional dimension of far-right ideology is something we also must take into account when analyzing authoritarian capitalism.
So tell me about this marriage with capitalism, then. And how this works out. And again, there's this appearance that Trump is at odds, not just with the mainstream media, but in some ways, even though he uses it, with media companies as well, including Google or Facebook. They don't come off, and Twitter, they don't come off as being big Trump supporters, yet they're all in it together, aren't they? And
yes. So, I mean, what has just happened in the past week is this Cambridge Analytica scandal, which is a bit hard to grasp, but if you boil it down, what happened? So Cambridge Analytica is a data firm where also Steve Bannon, the right-wing extremist former Trump advisor, played a role as a vice president. It's based in the US and in the UK. And what Cambridge Analytica did is that it operated via another company. It paid another company called Global Science Research for obtaining personal Facebook data from more than 50 million users, predominantly US American citizens. And how they did this is that a kind of personality test was organized via an app, and about 300,000 people participated in it. It was a kind of fake personality test. And what the app did is that it pulled lots of data from the profiles of all these people, plus also from all of their Facebook contacts, which is why it resulted in lots of data about 15 million users being sold by being gathered by this one company, Global Science Research, being sold to Cambridge Analytica. This included data like what kind of items do people like and dislike on Facebook. And what Cambridge Analytica then did is they created personality profiles. So they profiled people and then used this data for targeting political ads on Facebook. Facebook seems to have known about it also since some time, but did not really properly intervene, which is also why the past week it has come under massive attack. Mark Zuckerberg was somehow hiding. He could not explain what happened, really. Facebook's share price massively dropped. I mean, if you take the total value of the company on the stock market, I think it dropped by something like $70 billion. US dollars. So I think Cambridge Analytica is a story of how three things work together. On the one hand, digital capitalism, second, far-right ideology, and third, neoliberal politics. So first, far-right ideology. So these far-right ideologues like Trump, the Trump campaign, Steve Bannon, and so on, they will do whatever it takes with whatever means available in order to get their right-wing, far-right-wing messages out. And this includes massive data breaches and so on, as in this Cambridge Analytica scandal. Second, there's also digital capitalism. So all these stories that we hear about fake news on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and so on. Now it's also fake personality tests. And it's not an accident that it takes place on corporate social media, because corporate social media are particularly lax and liberal in terms of privacy protection. So basically, there is no privacy protection on these platforms. Whatever we do on corporate social media gets stored, analyzed, and sold as a data commodity. So Facebook, Google, Twitter are all about targeted advertising. That's their business model. So they are not communications companies. They are indeed the world's largest advertising companies. Yeah? So for Google, this meant in 2017, almost $13 billion in profits out of advertising, and Facebook around $16 billion profits. And that's only through advertising, targeted advertising. The data is sold as a commodity. Yeah? And also you could say that a commodity is something that is sold on the market. It has a certain value, but who produces the value of a commodity? The commodities are produced by workers who normally get a wage, and then the commodity is sold at a price above the investment costs so that the profit is made. Yeah? However, in terms of the data commodity is sold in the form of personalized advertising. Yeah? The data itself is produced by the users. So it looks like the users now become workers who produce the data commodity. However, they are not paid for it, so there's not a kind of wage for Facebook use. However, it results in $16 billion. So Facebook is among the 200 largest companies in the world now. And some people also talk about the users conducting digital labor and being a new kind of working class that is unremunerated and that constantly works. When we go to our Facebook profiles, that is constantly, whose labor, which is just our online activities then, is constantly exploited by the social media giants who turn the data into a commodity and also into profits. So it's profitable. The data breaches and so on are profitable for companies like Facebook and Google, which is also, it seems like that they have just simply watched, although they seem to have known about this specific data breach. Yeah? So in the end, they have a joint interest.
I want to ask you about another interesting aspect that I think is in line with this. Mark Zuckerberg, in responding to what happened when after everyone found out about Cambridge Analytica, said that they're going to come out with some type of algorithms or artificial intelligence, some type of process that's going to be used to be able to weed out fake news, for example, and to deal with these other issues. And I think you bring up, Christian Fuchs, a very important point here. They're not talking about actually paying fact checkers to look into this thing. They want to automate it, right? I mean, this was the New York Times. You know, you would like to think anyways that you have fact checkers who are paid to do the work to make sure this stuff is authentic. Facebook, and not just Facebook, I'm sure others as well, are looking to automate this process.
Yes, I mean, the point about Facebook and Google and so on is they operate predominantly on algorithms. Yeah? So most activities, like how the news feed works and what is selected, what is presented on it, how the advertising works and so on, there's not lots of human activity there. It's all already automated. Yeah, because the algorithms that run the targeted ads, yeah, they are blind for the content of what is being advertised. So for the Facebook advertising algorithm, it does not matter if you advertise chocolate bars or Coca-Cola or some form of fascism or some manipulative fake news. Yeah, so that's also what Marx calls commodity fetishism. Yeah? That commodity fetishism means that the commodity logic is blind to the social structures underpinning the commodity. Yeah? So it's a kind of blindness that capitalism brings along. And also, they are very overall, if you look at like Facebook and similar companies, they have very few employees. Yeah? And why do they have very few employees? Because on the one hand, algorithms operate there constantly. And on the other hand, there's the unpaid user labor. Yeah? So now we have all these problems where in the end, algorithms driving social media advertisement have become a threat to democracy. Yeah. So now one idea would be that all the news published on Facebook or videos uploaded to YouTube could be fact-checked by fact-checkers. And of course, fact-checkers, that's a profession. Yeah? They're all academically educated, but that's human labor, actually. Yeah. So if we would bring in more fact-checking to Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and so on, this would actually cost money, yeah? Which is why... It costs a lot of money, yeah? Because if you... I mean, if you, there are... thousands of hours of videos uploaded to YouTube each day. If someone would watch all of this, it would be lots of people actually. Yeah, but this would actually be the way forward. Yeah, if we want to save democracy, then we must make sure that not algorithms replace humans, but that more and more human work, such as the work of the fact checkers, replaces the algorithms. However, of course, if there would be a law that forces Facebook, Google, and others to hire fact checkers, or to pay for fact checkers, this would decrease their profits. Yeah? That's why Mark Zuckerberg or Facebook suggests the techno-deterministic version of arguing we will create another technology, another algorithm that will identify the fake news. Yeah? However, algorithms and technologies are fundamentally different from human beings. Yeah? So human intelligence, in the end, is different from artificial intelligence, because the algorithm or the technology, the computer, cannot interpret the context of a message. Yeah? So we know that algorithms can understand the syntax of a language. Yeah? It's just the kind of symbols that we are using. They can, however, not understand the meaning and the context. That's called in linguistics semantics and pragmatics. So this will simply not work, but it's clear that it's in the economic interest of Facebook of saying algorithms will handle it. Yeah? But it's also a kind of neoliberal tech determinism to argue that algorithms will save democracy. In the end, the capitalist algorithms of Google, Facebook, and so on seem to threaten democracy. So even if we now come in with even more of it, I cannot imagine that this will be the solution. The solution can only be that we bring in more human work and also that we take a much more radical step. Yeah, that we try to gain or establish a different kind of social media, a different kind of internet. So what is in the end very harmful to democracy is the profit logic of these large social media corporations. So I think we must start to try to decommercialize the social media, turn them, I think the only credible thing that could be done, undertaken to save Facebook, Google, and Twitter would be to turn them into non-profit cooperatives, where you don't have shareholders, but where the users and the workers own the companies. This is also being discussed nowadays under the term platform cooperatives. So a platform, an internet platform, that is owned and operated in a cooperative manner, but is a bit like alternative news media, like your radio station and so on, is non-commercial, is funded by the listeners and so on. But we could think of something like this also for social media. In the case of Wikipedia, it works. There is no advertisement on Wikipedia.
This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we are in conversation with Christian Fuchs. Christian Fuchs is a professor at Westminster University in the United Kingdom. He is also author of the book Digital Demagogue, Authoritarian Capitalism in the Age of Trump and Twitter. Christian Fuchs, I think your point about Wikipedia is interesting, and especially considering the dynamics around it and how it's maintained, is that it's pretty accurate. I mean, it's not perfect, obviously. We all know about mistakes that have been found on Wikipedia, but overall, it does seem to be pretty accurate, considering.
Yes, and Wikipedia has a different organizational model, because Jimmy Wales could have commercialized it at some point of time, and he would probably have become a billionaire like Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin and Google, the Google owners, and so on. But he chose not to do that, actually, because the very idea of the World Wide Web, when Tim Berners-Lee founded it in the late 1980s, was not that the web is for profit and is for capitalism. Yeah? So Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web as a commons, which means as a technological infrastructure that could be used by everyone without making a profit. And nowadays, Tim Berners-Lee, I mean, there were some recent interviews with him also, he's very concerned about the direction that Facebook, Google, and fake news online and so on is going. And he says it does not accord to the original idea. But of course, what one could also do is, because when we talk about this Cambridge Analytica scandal and so on, in the end, it's all about a scandal that has to do with targeted political advertising. Yeah? In some countries on the world, in the world, including Britain, there is a legal ban of political advertising in broadcasting. Yeah? So on the BBC and so on, during election campaigns, you cannot buy broadcast time for political advertisements. Yeah? And the underlying logic here is that if political advertising in the media is legal, then those with lots of money, corporate interests, will influence politics. Yeah? So if the political advertising ban, let's say in Great Britain now, where we already have a ban concerning broadcasting, if it would be extended to targeted advertising online, then this would be a step of how you regulate advertising. Yeah? It would still mean that there would be other forms of advertising, but specifically a political ad could no longer be targeted to users. Yeah? So I think this could be a further step of how that could be undertaken. Also, a third step could be, I mean, in Europe, we have a tradition of public service broadcasting and public service media. Yeah? In the US, you have less a tradition of that, but you also have PBS, but it receives much less funding than the big public service broadcasters in Europe. However, the public service broadcasters in Europe are banned from operating online and creating their own internet platforms. Yeah? What Europe tried to do and what the European Union tried to do since 20 years, yeah, is they tried to imitate the Californian ideology of neoliberal tech investments. So in 2000, the European Union passed a policy strategy called the Lisbon Strategy, and it says we will make lots of investments into what they call the digital single market, a free market for the internet, digital media. And they said by 2010, Europe will have caught up with the US in terms of the digital media industries and will have overtaken it. However, then in 2010, nothing had happened really. Yeah? It was still the American tech giants who were dominant. So what one had the idea that we build our European Google, or we will go build our European Apple or our European Facebook. All of this has not happened. So one simply misunderstood that the strength of the media landscape in Europe is not commercial online media, but is public service media. Yeah? And public service media are non-commercial in many countries. They don't use advertising. So the question would be, could public service be extended also to the internet and to internet platforms? Yeah? Could we have something like a public service internet? Yeah? And of course, what would be an example is that the public service broadcasters, they have lots of archives of archived radio material and archived television material. Yeah? Now imagine that a network of public service broadcasters operates their own YouTube as a kind of competitor platform to YouTube, where they make all of their archived material available based on Creative Commons licenses so that people could reuse it, remix it. You could build your own documentaries from it and so on. Yeah? And also, of course, the problem why we have the fake news culture, why we have Trump using Twitter in an authoritarian manner. In the end, it has to do with the very structure of the media system that we have experienced since decades. What could be called the tabloidization of the media. So in the end, political debate and political news has become very superficial. It's very compressed. It operates at high speed. There is not space and time for political engagement and for the exploration of political arguments. And also, it's all about individuals and about politicians as celebrities. There is simply not enough time for and space for exploring arguments, yeah, and for exploring causes of political problems. And in a public service internet, one could also think of different formats. Yeah? So there is one classical format of political debate. I think it's the best political debate format that was ever developed. It was in the 1980s on British television. It was called After Dark, but originally it comes from the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation, where it was developed in the 1970s under the title Club 2. So Club 2 was on public service television, an evening discussion program, which was live. Yeah? There were always like 5 or 6 guests and one host. It was always a hot, controversial issue that was being debated. And the one specific feature was it had open airtime. So it started around 10 in the evening, and it was not like 1 hour or 2 hours and then it's over. It was over when the guests decided it's over. Yeah? So sometimes they were discussing until 3 in the morning. And that's exactly what we're missing today. Yeah? So in the time when the political media are Facebook and Twitter and reality TV, there is simply no time and no space for engaged and deep political debate. However, if we would bring back this format, it was a television format, Club 2, and if we would turn it into Club 2.0 in the age of Web 2.0, where you would have the same format, yeah, on television, in a controversial, open-ended discussion program. But at the same time, we now have the potential to use social media differently. So people could maybe, to a certain extent, also participate in the discussions via social media, yeah, in a non-anonymous form where you must register with your name and also address, because anonymity also invites bullying. Yeah? But if people are non-anonymous, then it's normally a much better discussion debate. Or you could, for example, think of that there's a limited number of user-generated videos, for example, that are inputted into the television debate at specific points of time. So you could say a specific number of users can generate, like, let's say, a 3-minute video input on the on a video platform, and then arbitrarily you choose 1 or 2 of these videos and you broadcast them, and then the television participants also discuss and comment on the video. Yeah? So this would also engage the audience in the television format. And so the idea is to find formats that give time, space for sustained engagement with politics. We don't have that today. Yeah? It's like we live in a time of one-click politics, one-second politics. There's an extreme short attention span that we give to articles. Yeah? So if people read news online, we know that hardly anyone spends more than a minute looking at an article. So it's mainly a culture of headlines and so on. And of course, all of this culture is driven by profit interests. It's driven by the corporate media. Yeah? So in the end, we must overcome also the capitalist logic in the media. And if we try to decommercialize all types of media, yeah? Social media, the internet, but also broadcasting, newspapers, and so on, then in my opinion, that's really the only hope that we have for the future of democracy. So in the end, capitalism is a real danger and threat to democracy, and Trump is just an expression of how capitalism and right-wing ideology and tabloid media together threaten democracy.
Well, drive that point home for me, because on one hand, it sounds like we're talking about the rise of Donald Trump, what you call Trumpology, authoritarian capitalism. On the other hand, we're talking about this new online business capitalistic model presented by Facebook, Twitter, other companies. How do these two things come together?
Well, I think that on the one hand, you have the tech giants, Facebook and so on, yeah? Google, who make lots of money in an unregulated media environment. Yeah, so social media is completely unregulated. Yeah, so there. So neoliberalism has resulted in tech entrepreneurialism, where large, predominantly Californian tech companies, but there are also others like Chinese platforms like Weibo and so on, operate without having to abide to laws. Yeah? So there's a big discussions, for example, about tax avoidance, because tax legislation is national, but the tech giants, the internet platforms, they operate internationally. So they hardly pay any taxes. So neoliberalism is the context for the rise of corporate social media. At the same time, neoliberalism is also the context for the rise of Donald Trump and far-right authoritarian politics. Because what has happened is that neoliberal capitalism has given so much power to global corporations, has increased their profits constantly. At the same time, wages have been stagnating, inequality has increased, and what has happened is that neoliberalism has backfired. So at a specific point of time, the fears that people had played themselves out in support of right-wing authoritarian politicians who happen to be also billionaires like Trump. So I would say the combined context of social media corporations and Trump is neoliberalism. Neoliberalism has created the social media corporations. Trump is himself just how he is as a personality. That's neoliberalism, neoliberal subjectivity as such. And in the situation of crisis, I mean, when the 2008 economic crisis hit the U.S. and then spread all over the world, this crisis was also a crisis of neoliberal capitalism. The reaction to it, however, was in most countries in the world not a kind of politics that would have redistributed income from the rich and from corporations to everyday people and the mass of people. One further intensified neoliberal politics. And then at one point of time, also the left political forces were not strong enough, like Bernie Sanders in the US could not make the presidential nominations. Podemos, for example, in Spain is a left-wing party. These forces were gaining strength, but were not strong enough. And normally in history, when you have a crisis, a deep economic crisis, there is the danger that the far right gets stronger and stronger and stronger because they use nationalist politics. And if the left, if the socialists don't catch up and are not equally as strong, well, then you can have the transition from one type of capitalism to another. And I think what we're experiencing now in more and more parts of the world is the transition from neoliberal capitalism to authoritarian capitalism.
Christian Fuchs has been our guest. Christian Fuchs is a professor at the University of Westminster. He is co-editor of the journal Triple C, Communication, Capitalism, and Critique. He's the author of a number of books. The one we've been talking about, his latest, is called Digital Demagogue, Authoritarian Capitalism in the Age of Trump and Twitter. Christian Fuchs, I enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly.
All right. Nice talking to you. Thanks for having me on your program. Bye-bye.
That does it for Letters in Politics. Deanna Martinez is our producer. Lucille Rousseau is our intern. And Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can listen to our archive shows at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.
proactive resistance is a benefit for KPFA Radio and DACA support services. Featuring multi-Grammy Award winner Arturo Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra, the Bobby Cespedes Band, and the Son Jarocho All-Stars, plus special guests. Saturday, May 12, 7:30 p.m. at the UC Theater, 2036 University Avenue in Berkeley. Arturo Farrell says, quote, "We are thrilled to support the work at KPFA and its sacred commitment to truth and dialogue. Don't take KPFA's existence for granted. KPFA needs your support now more than ever. Support KPFA by attending Radioactive Resistance, featuring Arturo Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra, the Bobby Cespedes Band, and the Son Jarocho All-Stars, Saturday, May 12, 7:30 p.m. at the UC Theater, Berkeley. Visit theuctheater.org for more information. See you there."
You're listening to KPFA 94.1 and KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and